This is Craft Council from the Craft Council. Conversations with makers about their craft, their challenges, and the ideas that shape their future. For more information, find us via the Craft Council website, www.craftcouncil.org.uk, or on Instagram at Craft Council. You're listening to Craft Council from Craft Council. I'm Lewis Dalton-Gilbert.
And I'm Anna Fielding.
Today we're joined by Phoebe English, the visionary behind her self-named London studio. Honoured as a leader of change at the British Fashion Awards 2021, Phoebe has evolved her brand into a blueprint for circularity. From using plant-based dyes to keeping her entire production chain within the UK, she isn't just making clothes, she's redesigning the industry's future. Welcome.
Hello, Phoebe.
Oh, thank you, guys. Hi. Hello.
We're really pleased to have you with us. So you're in our studio today, but we were wondering, to sort of set a scene for our listeners, if you could tell us about your studio and what that looks like.
Yeah, sure. It's actually really nice, our studio at the moment. I really love being there. We're actually situated in a car park, which doesn't sound that glamorous, but we're sort of off the main studio building, and there's a sort of derelict site to one side of the car park, which has been overgrown with huge trees and is full of birds. So you can hear all this bird song in the studio, which is lovely. And it's a ground floor space with windows in the ceiling, so you get beautiful light coming in. And windows are all down one side, so you get light all coming through one side. And it's very small. It's a small space. It's full of our archive. So we've got big shelves that go all the way up to the ceiling. Just one pattern cutting table and three sewing machines and a couple of mannequins. And then some really big mirrors. And lots of plants. I really love plants, and I think they're integral to any studio or any space that humans are in. So yeah, lots of plants. So, you know, a very important feature of day-to-day life in the studio.
I love that you're sharing your space with other forms of life, with the birds and the plants. And
yeah, I think it's important. Otherwise, it's just a cupboard.
So, yeah. The Phoebe English biosphere.
Well, yeah, I mean, I did always envisage a studio with a stream coming down the middle and a big tree growing out the top of it. But we haven't quite got to the interior stream going in through the space yet. But in my brain, that's what it feels like.
I was just going to say, here's to your solar punk future.
Thank you.
I mean, you're very inspired by plants and nature, aren't you? And then especially in your latest collection, there's lots of flora and fauna in there. Could you speak a bit more about that?
Yeah, well, I think they're very sustaining in many, many ways. And yeah, I've found a lot of personal strength. Oh, that's really cheesy, but I've felt a lot of, I guess, an increased importance in how I connect with plants in recent times. There's something about the impermanence of them and the permanence of them. So having the stability of expecting particular plants to appear at specific times of the year and knowing they're going to appear. And then obviously they're such transient things, they sort of disappear and then something else comes and replaces them. I think for me, they're just so integral to how I experience day-to-day life. Even if I'm just walking along a road and there's a dandelion poking out the pavement, or like a wild rocket plant kind of poking into the road, I just always have really picked up on them, and they're quite an important part of how I experience the world and, you know, what I want to kind of pass on to my children. So yeah, they've become something that's transitioned into something that I'm including into my work. Whereas before it was, you know, they were something that was really important to me personally, that my work shifted quite recently. And the fact that there's this sort of literal usage of them visually in my work is quite a new thing, which I'm picking and trying to understand where it's come from. You know, there's also a tenderness to them. I think it's a time when we need as much tenderness as we can find.
I agree with that. It sounds like you would have made an incredible gardener, but how did you get into your chosen craft of being a fashion designer?
I'm actually a failed actor. I applied to maybe 15 different drama schools, and I didn't get into any of them or even have any callbacks from my auditions. So I felt like that was a sign that I should do an art foundation. I mean, I couldn't choose between drama and art, and I tossed a coin and it came out as drama. So I did a lot of that, obviously quite badly. And yeah, went for fashion, which it should have really been what I did anyway, because it was my longest interest. So my earliest memories are kind of thinking quite carefully about whether I disliked or liked a particular collar detail on my dresses as a little child and stuff, even when I was like kind of 3 or 4. So there's some of my really early memories are very clothes-centred, but they're also quite plant-centred as well. So maybe that's where it's coming back together. Yeah, and so I did a foundation and then chose to do fashion. I was lucky to get into St Martin's, which we're just very close to, but we were based in the Charing Cross campus, which is no longer there. And yeah, when I graduated, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I knew I didn't want to work in fashion. It sounds a bit confusing, because it's really definitely a school you go to if you want to work in fashion. But I wasn't interested in shops or who was wearing what in magazines. I just really liked making things. So, you know, I did a foundation and then I did a degree and then I did an MA because I liked making things. And I connected to that process of making. It was very central to who I was and who I am. And doing another collection beyond studying was an opportunity to keep making things. And, you know, it was just about making things, not necessarily about the fashion space beyond that. So, yeah, I made a small collection and I had some friends who were working. I think they had Saturday jobs at Dover Street Market. And, you know, one of them really kindly was like, oh, you know, you should show this to Dover Street. And they popped by and then the next day they put in an order and then I registered the business the following day. So it was just kind of through the kindness of others and rather than having a grand plan.
Well, I guess you still sort of make your own way in the fashion world, don't you? You don't follow the normal rules, I guess.
Maybe. I think it might also be that I don't know what the normal rules are. I feel like if I knew what the normal rules are, it would be a lot more straightforward. Or maybe I don't really like the normal rules. I think the bigness of it and the fastness of it, I've never really connected to, and I found quite difficult to join in with because of the fact that my work centres so much on the making. And for me, that's really the focus and the central part of it. And sometimes on those large scale and on those fast frameworks, the making is really not really included in the kind of importance of that way of being in fashion. So maybe that's one of the reasons it just never really fitted in some ways.
Do you think that this is the kind of thing that's allowed you to have a singular and original viewpoint, though? So the fact that you weren't playing by the same rules as everybody else is ironically probably what's made you more successful.
Oh, I don't know whether it's about more success. I think there's a lot of frustration. So, for example, I showed off schedule for, I think, for 5 years before I was accepted on schedule. And I was always really confused. You know, we did shows in like cafes or in like a tent on the car, in the car park, or we showed on like the digital schedule. And I was always really, I just couldn't understand what I was doing that was different and didn't fit into. So I don't know if it was like a conscious thing. Maybe now it's more conscious, but I just never really understood why it didn't always fit into what people were interested in or excited in. But yeah, I guess maybe over time we've just sort of made our own nook in a way, but not in an intentional way, just in a sort of accidental way, if that makes sense.
And you talked about your absolute love of making things. So to sort of pull back even further, what is it that craft in general means to you?
I think it means lots of things. And I'm sure you've had some really brilliant answers. And I was trying really hard on the way here to think, what does craft mean to me? And I feel like it's really a question I have to get right. But yeah.
There are wrong answers. Always so.
And I think I'm really interested in parts of us that are ancient parts of us. And I think that's one of the things that I really feel connected to in terms of craft or crafting something, is that I think it does connect to some parts of us that are very ancient. And I think that's very important. So I think that's important to me. But I'm also really interested in magic. And yeah, it is magical. And it is a form of magic. And it is a form of this sort of physical alchemy, in a way, to take materials and to transform them, often with your body or your hands, into something that can speak of sort of ancient heritage, but also of the current time it is made in. And I think that, for me, is really exciting and endlessly fascinating. And part of us that's very ancient, I think we forget those ancient things at our peril. Yeah.
I actually love that answer.
So within that space, what makers, artists or magicians do you admire?
I think Madame Grey is quite magical to me because it's such a mysterious practice, and the end items are so magical. I'm really interested in the engineering, and I wish I understood more about the engineering around historical garments or just any kind of pattern cutting, because I'm not a pattern cutter, I'm a textile designer. So I find all that sort of clever couture garment construction and the craft of that is deeply fascinating. And particularly in that work, they are like magic spells. I think that's one of the things that I love about, in fact, there's lots of things I don't like about fashion, but sort of historical objects, clothes as historical objects are so beguiling and mysterious. And the engineering I find so fascinating, how you can make a particular line or specific silhouette feel completely sort of without gravity or without formation, with really fascinating internal construction, which I don't understand myself because it's not my practice. But things like that I find really exciting.
I mean, I was nodding away wildly and making signs at you while you were talking about Madame Grey, but I wondered, for the rest of our listeners who may not be familiar, if you could tell us a bit more about her.
Yeah, so it's this amazing smocking or pleating of vast quantities of fabric into beautiful, almost effortless forms of gathered fabric, into these almost sort of Grecian sculpted forms. Yeah, and I think there's a lot of mystery surrounding the making process of how that was done. There's so many, but that's something I'm thinking about at the moment that I find really, spellbinding.
So you're not pattern cutting?
No.
But what tool couldn't you live without?
Pokey ones. Yeah, the pokey tools, so many different pokey tools. And I think along the way I've been given things. So yeah, thinking about, our studio spaces have sometimes been a bit larger, sometimes they've been a bit smaller, but there's specific tools that have sort of always existed within our space. So I have a collection of pin cushions, which are, really part of how I set up my space when it was just a table and a chair and one mannequin. And I have, the pokey tools is an amazing tool. I should know the name of it, but it's a It's like an arrow on a wooden handle, a metal pokey arrow on a wooden handle. And that would have traditionally be used to turn out the corners of collars. So when you turn them inside out and to poke to get those really nice sharp edges, pokey corners. And my ham is also important to me, which is the ball that you can iron on to get sort of nice curves on a sleeve head. So yeah, the ham, all the pokey tools and the pincushions. Yeah, those together would be something I would rescue if the studio was in danger or peril. Oh, and my tea pins, which I love, which are, I think, I might be wrong, but I think they're traditionally millinery pins. So they're big, strong, long pins with a T-shaped handle on them. And they look really aggressive, but they're really useful. And we use them every day for lots of different, sometimes fabric related purposes, but sometimes just to for useful pinages of paper. And yeah.
I wondered if you could talk a bit more about your team, actually, because you were saying, as you're the textile designer, you're not a graphic pattern card. I just wondered if you could speak a bit more about.
Yeah. So I have definitely had to learn to kind of work with other skills, because I don't have pattern cutting or natural dye as my skill. So yeah, I guess over the years we've had different people with that have come in and worked with me on pattern cutting who are just so talented. But yeah, I do really don't have that skill at all. So like learning and building those relationships have been really important, because you can't just sort of get someone in that can pattern cut and then just make a garment. It's just a really precious relationship, actually, that can take years to develop. Mm. Yeah, when I've worked with people where we can just communicate about the work without communicating. I don't know if that makes sense, but when you have a mutual understanding, and I'm sure all fashion studios are full of these very special links, especially in bigger houses in Paris. Yeah, it's almost like kind of like a horse whispering kind of thing, where you sort of, you're working in the same space and you come to this point where there's an equilibrium in the understanding of the next stage of each development, and where you can know that your decision will already have been decided on and it will already be happening before you've even, you know, sat down and had a conversation. So I've been really lucky to have several relationships like that through my practice, and I really cherish those people and everything that they've contributed to the studio. And it is always really sad when people go for new adventures, but then you also get to meet, you know, other practitioners as well along the way. But that is one of the things I really love about the studio, is building those really precious working relationships, because it is a friendship in many, many ways. And they're really precious memories that I hold from my working life. You know, and it is really hard running a studio, and can sometimes feel like, oh, what is this? this is completely impossible. And then sometimes when I look back and think about all of the wonderful working relationships I built with different practitioners, and for me, that's one of the really precious things about the endeavor that I'm trying to do is, yeah, those bonds that you make, those working bonds that you make. It is a friendship, but in many ways it's beyond a friendship, because you have this sort of sinking of creative practice, which is a different thing from a friendship. A partnership. Yeah, and the fashion industry is full of studios with these special invisible partnerships that you just don't experience from looking in. And you would only experience if you were working in that space. And I think that's one of those kind of mercurial, magical things as well.
Well, you mentioned then that it's so difficult, then this can be really hard.
Yeah.
And I don't want to take you back to that place, but what are the obstacles that you're currently facing?
Yeah, it is hard. It is hard. Absolutely. It's definitely not an easy path. I think for me, like, I just don't think I'd really be able to do anything else. So it's just like kind of a necessary path for me, because I think one of my friends was like, he looked at me once and he was like, I think you'd just be completely unemployable if you tried to get a job. I was like, oh, thank you. But you just get like all different skill sets from kind of working in your own way that maybe renders you useless in other places. But it can be elating and exciting and brilliant and rewarding, but it is also really hard work. It's hard graft. I think running any studio or any business, it is a discipline. Like, it's an absolute discipline. It's like being I'm not one of these people, but I guess it would be the same as being a sports person or dancer or a singer. Like, it's a real discipline. You have to be there, you have to be thinking about it all the time, you have to deliver, and then you have to come and do it the next day and consistently. So you're constantly striving to kind of protect that space to work in and to be able to attain enough to do the next piece of work from the last piece of work. So the discipline has to be consistent. And that is really exciting when you're young and you have lots of energy. And then I think with fashion businesses, you get to about kind of 7 years and it's like, oh, it's still going. It's still put that energy in, and it, you know. But I think for us, we've kind of evolved. You know, we used to do 4 collections and we evolved to do 2 collections, and we can join the collections together into a more fluid selection of work rather than a gendered selection of work. So, and then we dropped out of Fashion Week frameworks by just doing 1 collection a year, which was a really, it sounds like so flippant just to say it as a sentence, but it did take years to build up to do that. And we've had larger studios and smaller studios, and I do lecturing and I give talks and bits of teaching and consultancies. We've sold to shops, and we do one-on-one private customers. We have had e-commerce. So we've tried and explored lots of different iterations, which keeps it really interesting. You know, we moved away from using virgin fabrics and now only use waste materials. That took a number of years and was lots of research and relearning and reteaching and educating. So, you know, I think like approaching the studio with this discipline, but also keeping the energy to sort of keep transforming it or transmuting it into a different version of itself, and being amenable to that, because it just, you can't survive in a fixed state. The world moves very quickly, and often things you're doing are rendered completely irrelevant very quickly. And I don't mean that by like, oh, you have to work fast and choo, choo, choo. But it's more kind of a slow responsiveness, I think. I don't know if that answers the question. That sort of like potted along to different places.
But also, yeah. I think you could do lots of different jobs, actually. Identified gardener. Magician.
I would love to retrain. I keep bringing it up, and Sam's like, absolutely not. It's like another thing going on. But yeah, one day I'll have a garden and then I can practice my skills.
I mean, this is a perfect question now, but, and it's one we've been asking everyone, but it seems particularly pertinent to you, which is, what other craft would you love to master? So many.
There's so many. I mean, we had a stint where our studio space was in cockpit studios, mm-hmm. which was just a disaster because there was just so much craft everywhere and it was impossible to focus on doing any work because I just wanted to wander around and like look at the basket weaving and see instruments being made and shoes being made. It was like so overstimulating and overexciting. Maybe an unexpected one, maybe some kind of digital space, some craft. Yeah, I mean, I'm the kind of person, if I go near a computer, it just stops working. That's like kind of running joke in my life. I'm just not very good digitally, and I would love, yeah, I think if there was any imaginary kind of new sphere I could explore, it would be trying to explore the how digital and craft can sort of where that's going as a space, because it's just something I know nothing about, but I'm sure could be extremely exciting. Yeah.
And dream case scenario.
Yeah.
If time, money, and physics were no object, what could you create? What would you create?
Maybe something like a sort of grand, operatic, immersive, crafted, elemental experience that people could just come and witness and be part of. Things made from air and soil which is suspended in space, plants that could grow in the dark. Yeah, all these sort of, yeah, extraordinary elemental things. Water that can float. Yeah.
I think we need to get you a commission at the Chelsea Flower Show.
I want to be
streams
in this space.
In the sky.
I want to be in this world.
Yeah.
Wings made out of rocks. Yeah, all sorts of things.
Oh, I love this. I can see it so vividly. I don't know if it matches up to your vision, but in my head it looks amazing.
Great. Let's do it.
Have you ever been given a piece of really good advice? Or conversely, do you think you've actually given any really good advice?
Oh, God, no, I don't know about my own advice. I feel like a wise old sage. He's like, yes, this is my advice to you. But especially with parents, because I'm a parent now, so it's like passing. It's quite useful when other people pass on parenting advice. So I feel that's the kind of advice I'm giving out at the moment. But I think the best advice I was ever given was by one of my aunts. I've got lots of aunts, just all really incredible people. But yeah, back to the acting years. And yeah, and I was so nervous about auditioning and things, and that all the drama schools had different audition requirements. And a lot of them required you to do a song. And I just can't sing at all. And I was so frightened and nervous about having to sing in front of people. I was absolutely terrified. And one of my aunts, who is a performer, and she was like, just sing how you sing. And I was like, oh, yeah, I could just sing how I sing and not worry that it doesn't sound like how I think singing should sing. That's it. Anyway, that's just always stuck in my mind is, yeah, just sing how you sing. Basically, yeah, get what you're given.
I think you can.
You'll get what you're given from me.
You can apply it to lots of things, can't you?
Yeah.
It's kind of it's almost like if we're going to go down for the acting years, thine own self be true kind
yeah.
of.
Yeah. And I just was like, yeah, just you don't have to. I think because I thought, when I thought about singing, I thought, you know, I was like, Mariah Carey, like, how am I going to attain these like incredible standards? But actually, yeah, just be yourself and do what you can with your own skills.
Thank you so much, Phoebe. It's been great having you with us. And I think that's quite a lovely, I don't know about you, Lewis, I think that's quite a lovely philosophical note to end on.
I agree. Be yourself. Sing how you sing.
Sing how
you climb every mountain, yeah. Ford every stream and sing how you sing.
Thank you. I don't sing. But
we're not going to ask you. Don't worry.
No, please don't. Thank you very much for having me, guys.
Thank you, Phoebe. Thank you for listening to Crafts Council from Crafts Council. We'll be back soon with artist Mark Caulfield Moore. And until then, goodbye.